So we are continuing our series in talking about contemporary issues and applying wisdom. So the sort of the purpose of the series is to help us think about some of the modern issues that we are facing and in the world today, and that our children and grandchildren are growing up with and facing, and how do we think through those things biblically? How are we going to evaluate them? That's our aim. So this is lesson number 4, and I've entitled this "Life to 280." Exodus chapter 21. Go ahead and read verses 18 to 27. "And if men strive together, and one smite another with a stone or with his fist, and he die not, but keepeth his bed, if he rise again and walk abroad upon his staff, then shall he that smote him be quit. Only he shall pay for the loss of his time, and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. And if a man smite his servant or his maid with a rod, and he die under his hand, he shall surely be punished. Notwithstanding, if he continue a day or two, he shall not be punished, for he is his money. If men strive and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished, according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. And if a man smite the eye of his servant, or the eye of his maid, that it perish, he shall let him go free for his eye's sake. And if he smite out his manservant's tooth or his maidservant's tooth, he shall let him go free for his tooth's sake." I remember an article that was published about 10 years ago in The Atlantic, and it was written by a woman named Anne Marie Slaughter, and it was titled, "Why Women Still Can't Have It All." And she, Slaughter, was the first woman director of policy planning at the State Department, a pretty significant accomplishment, she felt. And she was on a 2-year leave from her job at Princeton, where she was a law professor. So she was a high-level, high-profile career woman with her dream foreign policy job in Washington, D.C., rubbing shoulders with the highest level working women in the United States. So she also talked about in that article the long, demanding hours. I think she said something to the effect that her week began 5 a.m. on Monday morning and did not end until late Friday night. And talked about all the things that was going on there, and many trips and different things. Well, the problem that she ran into while holding her dream job in Washington, D.C., was the same problem that so many other women that she knew were having, and that was trying to have it all as a high-level career woman and having a family as well, particularly having children. So her dream job in D.C. coincided with her two sons' early teenage years. And they were left at home with their father and her husband in New Jersey while she's working in D.C. and then commuting back home on the weekends, you know, Saturday and Sunday. And she came to realize during this time, and this is what she writes about in this article, she came to realize the lie to the feminist propaganda that she should be able to have it all while being thin and beautiful. She added that part. So the article was surprisingly honest. It's also very long. When she told some other women that she was planning to write it, they were shocked and appalled, actually. Told her, "You can't do that. You can't write that." I mean, especially, you know, her, of all women who seemed to have it all and to be such an ideal role model for the younger generation. And so she goes on to give some proposed solutions in that article, which are problematic in a number of ways. But she still maintained throughout that she recognized there's a problem here. And it not only affected her, but it affected women in general. And though she didn't say it, her article and her experiences show where that real sticking point is for the feminist dream, and that is children. That is that's the hump you can't get over, so to speak. Laws, policies, rules, these are things that can be changed. Organizations can be changed. Corporate structures can be changed. All of these are things that can be changed, but having and caring for children is a disadvantage for women competing against men that there's no law that can change. Or can it? So, here in Exodus, we're looking at part of the Old Covenant law. And the Old Covenant law was a justice system of common law. All right? A justice system of common law. So, here's what that means. By justice system, I mean that the Old Covenant law was a system of restitution and not retaliation. So the emphasis of the Old Covenant law was restitution. So you can see it here in verses 23 down to 25. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So this is a statement that is intended toward restitution, not retaliation, and that is evident when you look at the surrounding context of this passage that we read, as well as other aspects of the law. So restitution as a legal principle is concerned with restoration. All right. So if I stole something from you, then the aim of restoration is that, or restitution rather, is that there's a restoration made to you. So the law would have the replacement. Let's say an animal was stolen. That animal would be replaced, plus there would be, I think in some cases it was a 20% of the value. If the animal could not be replaced, then the value of the money plus the 20% had to be given. So the aim of the law was a restitution. Now today, if you steal something, a whole lot of money is going to be paid to the government, and probably maybe imprisoned on the taxpayer's bill, and the person that had their property stolen most likely will receive nothing. Only maybe in the case of if they carried some sort of insurance, and that insurance will cover it, but the legal system doesn't generally cover it. So the Old Covenant law was a system that was focused on restitution, that there would be, when someone was wronged by another, according to the law, that there could be a restoration of that wrong. Retaliation, on the other hand, is merely focused on revenge, getting back. So someone stole from me, so I'm going to go steal from them, or I'm going to go steal from someone else. It's sort of a getting even sort of system. Well, that's not the system of the Old Covenant law. It's a justice system, which means it's focused on restitution and restoration. And there's many laws that deal with that and all kinds of different cases where that is made. So, for instance, if we look here, look at verses 18 and 19. If men strive together and one smite another with a stone or with his fist, and he die not, but keepeth his bed, if he rise again and walk abroad upon his staff, then shall he that smote him be quit, only he shall pay for the loss of time and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. So verses 18 and 19 give us what in legal terms we would call a case. All right, so here's a case in verses 18 and 19. The case considers two men who are fighting. Now, the cause of the fight between them is not stated. Most likely, it would be some sort of escalation of an argument. In other words, it's not a fight that has resulted from some sort of criminal activity, but probably some sort of dispute or whatever it would be. So if in this process, one of the men kills the other man, then that offender would be put to death. And that's what the punishment there means. It's the punishment according to the law, life for life. So he would be put to death. And it would be life for life because you cannot make full restitution when you have taken the life of someone else. So if two men got in a fight and one damaged the other one's property, for instance, well, then they could pay the restitution. They could fix whatever was damaged. They could pay whatever was required, and there could be a restoration made. If he kills the other person in the process of the fight, there's no way to restore that, as if like a stolen animal or something. Now, it's pointed out in here that he smites him, or he hits him with a stone or with his fist. And the idea here is probably means something grasped in his hand, like he's taken hold of something heavy, like a stone or like something, and he's hit the other man so that he is wounded. Now, when we look at this case, we can see that this is not talking about a case of self-defense. This isn't talking about a man that got jumped on the street at night, you know, an attempted robbery or something like that, where he's threatened with weapons and he's just defending himself. That's obviously not the case. Again, this is some sort of dispute between these two that has escalated in violence. And talking about this stone or this clenched fist means that the case is such that there was an unreasonable and an excessive force that was used on the part of the one that did the hurt to the other. So that's what we're considering. Excessive force resulting in bodily injury. In this case, the offender would have to pay the victim. All right, so in one outcome, the other guy dies, and then in that case, then his life is forfeit, and he gets the death penalty. In the other case, the guy lives, but he is wounded. Then the one who did it has to pay for his lost time, meaning his loss of income, and his medical expenses. See what it says there at verse 19? He shall pay for the loss of his time and shall cause him to be thoroughly healed. So if in the course of this fight he injures the other man and he's down for some amount of time, then the other one is liable to pay for his loss of income as well as his medical expenses. All right, so again, this just highlights that the concern here is restitution. The concern here is a restoration. So there's a wrong here. How can it be set right? And that is the common thread as you look through these different cases in these verses that we read. That's the common thread, that there's an emphasis on restitution and how restitution is going to be achieved. All right, so that's a justice system. All right, the second term I used is that the Old Covenant law is a justice system of common law. And by common law, I mean what is also referred to as case law. Case law, the way that case law works, is that the law is given in minimal principle and then applied in different cases where precedent for the application of the law is established. So you get a law code or statute that's a minimal principle. Then you get a case where that statute is applied, and that case sets a precedent for future cases as to how that law applies. All right, so that's what common law or case law means. So if you consider the principle, all right, so here's the principle, the minimal principle, Exodus 20:13. Thou shalt not kill. That's what we recognize as one of the Ten Commandments. That's the minimal principle stated. Thou shalt not kill. Now, verse 20 here in Exodus 21 speaks about if a man kills his slave, whether it's a male or a female slave, if he kills his slave, he has to be punished. And what that means is that he's punished according to the law, which is life for life, so he's to be put to death. So he kills his slave, he is to be put to death. So that's an application. The principle, thou shalt not kill. Here's a case, a master who has beaten his slave for whatever reason, and so the slave dies, then that master is liable and he has to pay life for life, meaning that he is put to death. All right, so that's how it works. Another way that this works is when we look at verses 18 to 19, the men that were fighting, we realize that that's a case where we have an application, and that same principle would be applied the same way if it were two women fighting. So, for instance, the law nowhere says if two women strive together and one smite another with a stone and so on. The law never says that. So does that mean that this law is only for men? No. It's a case. It's an application of the law, and it would be the same thing if it was two men or two women who were fighting. So that's how case law works, and it's how the law of the old covenant works as well. Paul understood the law this way. So when you read what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians, I forget the chapter now, I'm thinking maybe in chapter 9, where he refers to the law about not muzzling an ox that treads out the corn. All right, so the law not to muzzle an ox that treads out the corn is a case. This is a case. What's being applied? What's being applied is the minimal principle of not stealing. You don't steal. In other words, that ox is doing a labor for you. That ox is earning a wage, which would be the corn that he's treading out. So you don't steal from that ox by muzzling him and not allowing him to eat, which is also then applied. The same principle is applied to workers. So if you hire a day laborer to do a job for you, then you are liable for their pay. You are accountable to pay them. And it's the very same principle, and that's the same thing that Paul refers to in 1 Corinthians chapter number 9, applying that case law. All right, so understanding all of this as far as how the old covenant law works and how it's given and how it works, what does the old covenant law have to do with women's rights? And that's what we want to look at here, the law and women's rights. So, verse 22, if men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, and yet no mischief follow, he shall be surely punished according as the woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, then thou shalt give life for life. All right, so these verses describe, this is a case. And this is a case where men are fighting for whatever reason, again, dispute, whatever reason is going on. But in this case, the men who are fighting in some way, inadvertently, injure a pregnant woman, leading to an involuntary abortion of the pregnancy. All right, so that's the case that we're looking at here. Now, this application of the case, or this precedent, gives us two different outcomes. Okay, one outcome is what it says, no mischief follows, meaning that both mother and baby live and are fine. Even though still the incident caused an abortion of the pregnancy. So the baby is delivered, but mother and baby live and they're fine. Well, then it says the guilty man or men, who in this case, whichever it shall be, will be fined and punished because of the injury that they did through their own negligence. The second outcome is that either one or the other, or both, mother and baby die. And in that case, the guilty man or men shall be put to death. In other words, punished according to the law, life for life. So this case is a liability case, meaning that though the aborted pregnancy was accidental, and you notice that about the case, this is not a deliberate action to abort the pregnancy. This is an accidental cause of abortion of pregnancy. However, if either the mother or the baby die, the man is still liable life for life and will have the death penalty. So this was an accidental aborted pregnancy. It was caused, though, by the men that were fighting. So the death penalty is required in either case of the death of the mother or of the unborn baby. Because, once again, there's no restitution for life. There's no way to restore a life that has been taken. That's the principle. Life for life. This is why the death penalty is required in this situation. So, one thing we learn here is that babies had protection and right to life from conception to 280, which is about the number of days to a full term of and birth for a pregnancy, obviously beyond that as well. But the point is that the law recognized that baby in the womb as having life, as being alive. Well, this law is actually one of several in the law that provided protection for women and preserved the rights of women. So some of the other places would be like the example of levirate marriage. And so if a woman's husband had died and there was no male heir, then she essentially was impoverished. She had no inheritance, and the levirate marriage would produce an heir and obviously provide for her for, you know, the rest of her life. This is sort of an issue in the book of Ruth. So the law of levirate marriage, some of the laws of redemption, which certainly came into play in the book of Ruth, and the laws of inheritance in the case of no male heir, and I believe that was the daughters of Zelophehad that Moses presided over and ruled over. And even in the laws of divorce or of putting away, and in the case of a second wife, there's actually protection for a woman in the law if her husband doesn't divorce her but takes a second wife. There's actually protections in the law for her in that sort of case. So within the law, there are a number of different protections and preservations of the rights of women in the law. So the laws of life cover life for all. That was men, women, slaves, children, and even unborn babies, as we see in this passage. All equally have the same right to life under the Old Covenant law. And the reason why is because all human beings are created in the image of God. And actually, that right to life predates the law. The law just simply continues that. But all human beings are created in the image of God and given life by Him, and that life is required at the hands of any who kills another. So this is one place that we see from the Bible. This, again, just one place we see from the Bible that God regards that unborn baby in the womb as a person with life. And so here we see why Christians should regard the life in the womb as well as the life outside of the womb. Why Christians should see abortion for what it is, which is murder. But what does this have to do with women's rights? So we come back to this again. Now, I don't know Anne Marie Slaughter's position on abortion, and I know nothing beyond that article that I read again 10 years ago, but though I did clip it because I always clip articles that I just find interesting for whatever reason. But I don't know what her position on abortion is or was. I don't. I could speculate, but what good would that be? I don't know. And I don't remember it being mentioned in that long article at all. But it's obvious. In other words, the question of abortion is obvious when you consider that the constant sticking point for achieving the feminist dream is birthing children. Again, it's the hump you just can't get over. And so abortion is a major, maybe even a primary tool for women to live how they want and to achieve what they want to achieve in life. And again, enabling them to be competitive with men. You need to pay attention to the rhetoric. When you listen to people talking about abortion and arguing about abortion, and we had obviously with the overturning of Roe this past summer. There's been a lot of it, and don't think for a minute that that it's not realized that Roe was overturned not because abortion was ruled morally evil. It wasn't. It was simply that it was not within the constitutional law, that Roe ruling. So all that means is, hey, we've got to change these laws. And all of that has already been under effort for a long time. Pay attention to the rhetoric that is used. People know that baby in the womb is alive. And all the medical terms of embryos and fetus and viability and clumps of cells and everything that you hear people saying are merely deflections from the real issue, because the real issue is not the issue of the life of the baby. That's not the real issue in the issue of abortion, particularly in this country today. What is the argument for abortion called? Pro-choice. Pro-choice. This is supposed to be an issue about women's rights. It's supposedly all about a woman's body. And men don't have the biological credibility to speak to it. But that's sort of getting all confused and mixed up here lately, isn't it? It's said to be about reproductive freedom. And if I don't misremember, those were the words that President Barack Obama used concerning abortion and talking about how he wanted his daughters to be able to grow up and to have every opportunity and to have reproductive freedom as they pursued their careers and their lives. All those are very great sounding things, right? But when we cut through all of that, the issue is really about women having the right to have sexual activity without consequences and use abortion as birth control. That really is the issue. And again, people know that that baby is alive. People know that. People know that's a baby. People know that's a human being. If you remember the undercover Planned Parenthood videos from several years ago, and you know, watching through some of those and just hearing that talk, so repulsive as it was. But oftentimes, those workers would continually refer to them as babies. Why? Because they thought they were off camera. They thought they were off the record. They weren't being recorded. They weren't putting out propaganda. They were just talking. They're constantly referring to them as babies. They know that those are babies. They know that they are alive. That is not the real issue. That's a distraction from the real issue. So really what the pro-choice abortion movement is really all about, and that whole argument is really all about, it is simply about that, the use of abortion as birth control and it being available and accessible to every woman to be able to have it. It's easy for Christians to get distracted sometimes by the so-called science of the arguments and also by the women's rights angle. But Christians should see the unborn as living human beings created in the image of God. And we should also see the issues clearly enough to recognize that fornication, adultery, sexual activity outside of marriage is just taken for granted. It's just taken for granted. Like that's, in all of the debates and the things that I've read and listened to and I have seen, like that seems to never even come up. That's just taken for granted. It's hardly even talked about. Well, the Bible unquestionably and completely clearly teaches that sexual activity outside of a one-man, one-woman marriage is sin and therefore should not be done. Hebrews 13:4. Marriage is honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. And murder is also sin, whether the baby is born or whether the baby is unborn. All right, so now my point here is not to say that we are under the old covenant law. That's not been my point. We're not under the old covenant law. But adultery and fornication and murder were all present before the law was given, and were all sins before God, before the law was ever given, just as they were after that the law was fulfilled. In other words, God teaches without question that these things are sins for which he will bring men and women into judgment. That's completely clear. You know, we could go to Romans 1 and many other places. But my point is that, or rather, why Christians should view abortion as the Bible does. How that we think about these things, how that we apply the Word of God, how that we think through these things biblically. And yes, there are those who profess to be Christians who will take the pro-choice argument and side and have fallen for a number of deceptions in that regard. But we have to think biblically about these things, recognizing that life created in the image of God, whether it's inside the womb or outside the womb. But we also need to say as Christians that, or rather, we need to understand and communicate the good news of the gospel as well. So lying, stealing, sexual sin, murder, these are all sins, along with a whole host of others, that require the same judgment of death. According to God's holiness and God's righteousness that he has revealed to us, these are all things that inherit the wrath of God and eternal condemnation. All of these, and again, and many more. But the good news is that Jesus died in the place of sinners to pay the sin debt of death for them, so that all who believe can be forgiven and justified from all such sins, and again, as well as many more, and inherit eternal.